Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, President's Day, February 16, all things political, and we'll be starting with Beyond Our Borders for all things political this hour. Today, Egypt said it bombed Islamic State targets in Libya in retaliation for mass beheadings of Egyptian Christians on a Libyan beach. President Obama's draft proposal submitted to Congress on fighting ISIS calls for limited use of U.S. ground troops and no geographical limits on going after extremist groups. Some members of Congress are calling for more U.S. military presence around the world, and we'll be talking about what the U.S. strategy is. We'll discuss U.S. politics as well. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is in the top three preferred Republican presidential candidates in Iowa and New Hampshire. And are the Democrats interested in anyone other than Hillary Clinton? And the new governor of Illinois issued an executive order last week barring state unions from assessing fair share fees on some of the workers they represent in collective bargaining. We'll talk about that, which may be headed to the Supreme Court at some point in time. So that's a few of the areas that we'll be discussing this hour. And our guest is Professor Charles Lipson. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He specializes in international relations and international political history. He is co-director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security, and its workshop for graduate students. He's author of Reliable Partners, How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace. And he's done a lot of work on education and academic integrity. We'll be welcoming phone calls. And here is how you reach us, 1-800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Lipson, nice to talk to you again. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
It's great to hear from you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So who's your favorite president?
Who's my favorite president? Well, I think that there are two of who just rise above everything, and they're the two we're celebrating, Washington and Lincoln. Since everybody knows how great Lincoln was, let me say something about Washington.
Please.
Have a moment. I want you to think about Castro, who won power in a civil war and then kept it until he could physically no longer keep it. And Ho Chi Minh, it was the same way. And if you think about Lenin, it was only because he died, and Mao and so forth. Part of Washington's true greatness is not only that he gave up power as president, he had to be asked to run a second time, and then he stepped down, right? But he did the same thing when he was in the military. He gave up his sword. He walked in after the war was won and said, I am not going to do what Mao would later do, what Castro would later do, what the Ayatollah Khomeini, what most people do, Ho Chi Minh, win a war for independence, for their or for their particular version of a regime, and then keep power until they die.
Right.
He not only did that, he not only gave up his sword, some of his key officers had not been paid, and he was out of town at the time, and he came back, and they wanted to stage a coup at the end of the Revolutionary War and install him as a king, in part so that he would pay them. And he forced them to stand down. So he again and again set us on the road to democracy because he refused to become a King George Washington. And we really need to remember that. It's great that we remember what Lincoln did. He kept the Union together. It's great that we remember at this time of year what Martin Luther King did. We're honoring King not only in his person but as the exemplar of the great movement of the middle of the 20th century to win legal equality for blacks and beyond that for all minorities. But we should also remember that Washington did something that had never been done up until that time, which was helped create a democracy, a genuine democracy.
Well, happy President's Day to you, and thanks for that answer. It was a good one.
I appreciate you saying it. It's something that we live with every day and that the world has imitated, and that we can forget how rare it has been in human history.
Yes. All right, let's go beyond the borders for some time here. Egypt saying today it bombed Islamic State targets in Libya. The president giving a proposal to Congress on fighting ISIS. What do you think, Professor Libsyn, the U.S. strategy is in confronting this group, and what should we be doing that we're not?
We don't have a strategy. That's the first thing. Let me back up and say what I mean by that. During the Cold War, we had a strategy, and the strategy was you contain the Soviet Union and don't let them expand beyond the borders that they acquired in the aftermath of World War II, where the Red Army was. And eventually, the hope was they would implode, and they actually did. That was a strategy. In World War II, we had a basic strategy. It was set before the war began, and it was when Churchill and Roosevelt met in Canada just before we were bombed at Pearl Harbor, and they decided Europe first. That is, we had to fight the Nazis and defeat them before we defeated Japan. And the reason for that was that if the Nazis took over all of Europe, it would be almost impossible to disgorge them. So we would hold Japan at bay if they attacked us. And then we hoped beat them after, probably by 1947, after we had defeated the Nazis. So those are strategies. Those are large visions of what we want to do and how we will deploy our resources. A lot of your listeners have probably read books about General Douglas MacArthur in the Pacific, and MacArthur was always complaining, I don't have enough resources. My dad was fighting in the Pacific. You know, they wanted more resources. But in fact, the United States was able to defeat Japan without diverting a lot of resources from Europe. But that was what our basic strategy was. We do not have a strategy for defeating Islamic terrorism. Indeed, the current president won't even say the name of the enemy. I don't know how you can defeat them without even acknowledging who they are. Bush had a strategy, but we know what its limitations were, and we know where it failed and so forth. So I would say that the problem is that you put your finger on with your first really hard question is, what's our strategy? And the short answer is we don't have one.
Secretary of State John Kerry has said the U.S. was on the road to defeating ISIS. You think that's true?
The short answer is no, I don't think we are. But remember, ISIS is not the whole of the problem. President Obama was reelected on the grounds that the main threat was al-Qaeda. He mocked Romney for saying that Russia was the threat. Al-Qaeda was the threat. And al-Qaeda was, quote, on the run. And then when that proved palpably false, they modified the narrative to say core al-Qaeda was on the run. But core al-Qaeda has morphed into all these affiliate groups. Is Boko Haram on the run? No. They're killing and capturing in large numbers. What about Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and it's sort of now taking over in Yemen. They're not on the run. So, in other words, we may be defeating parts of it. And with respect to ISIS, we've made some progress in Iraq. It's mixed. Basically, if everything possible went right, we would kind of get back close to where Bush had left this president. After all the mistakes, we had actually managed to get things right toward the end with the surge and the Anbar awakening. President Obama came in and pulled everybody out, including all of our intelligence. We lost all those gains. We might be able to win some of those back. It'll be very hard. But we can't win anything serious in Syria, and it's not just a question of putting boots on the ground. Of course, you can't win in Syria without putting boots on the ground. There's nobody even for us to ally with there. On one side is the group that Hafez al-Assad, who is in power now, Bashir is in power, having succeeded his father, Hafez, and they're allied with Iran. That's one side. The other side is ISIS, and in between the two is like a very small group. It was much larger a few years ago that opposes both of them, and that's what President Obama said he would back, but then he didn't do anything. And when he didn't do anything, what happened was the Assad regime started killing off all of those, quote, moderates. I don't even know how moderate they were, but they all got killed off, so there are not many of them left. And the strategy, if you want to call it that, is we should go in and train a few of them. That's not a strategy. Mm-hmm. It won't win. It'll take forever. And bombing from the air is not going to do it.
Senator McCain has suggested that, well, in addition to more U.S. military presence around the world, he says that the president should not have pulled out of places like Afghanistan and Iraq. In his words, you have to have a stabilizing force. You're also going to have to have American boots on the ground. Did it make a difference in the rise of these groups for us to have pulled out of Iraq and beginning to pull out of Afghanistan?
I want to distinguish between Afghanistan and Iraq. I think they're pretty different situations. But the answer is yes, in a very big way. If you're a lot of the groups that are opposed to each other in Iraq manage to form a kind of trust with the United States. So what happened when the United States pulled out was they went back at each other. And in particular, the government in Baghdad reached out to Iran as its major supporter. They were Shia. Iran is Shia. They reached out as their major supporter. They then turned the government into a giant Shia militia on steroids and started wiping out all the gains that we had made in the Anbar awakening. That was Sunni and a number of the other areas. So these groups were all kind of depending on us as a stabilizer. And we weren't really fighting and losing a lot after this had been stabilized. This was, in effect, a victory that was forfeited by a policy that we now know has failed utterly. And then to try to get to win back what the president himself had lost, he recognized you couldn't do it with Nouri al-Maliki, had to get him out, get somebody else in. They've slowly begun to restore things. But if you were in that region, would you think, well, the United States is going to stay there for a long time and really help support things, or would you look to Iran? And a lot of the Shia are just looking to Iran.
Mm-hmm. And before we move to domestic matters, do you have any understanding, Professor Lipson, of what it is that's attracting people to these organizations?
You know, the dissatisfaction that is palpable with a lot of the local governments there is a big driver. The fact that the governments are corrupt, have not led to jobs and blah, 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 you know, I mean, the full litany, those are all real. But it's worth thinking about the fact that we've had Somali youth from Minneapolis go over and join. Well, Minnesota has a good economy and a democracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just say it's, if we got a democracy and a good economy, everything would solve itself. There are a lot of problems, and I've got to tell you, the big problem that is now knocking on about this is what's happening in Europe, and it's not only these terrorist attacks, but the terrorist attacks are really rooted in communities that are large. The Muslim community in France is now 10% of the population. And it's not a Muslim community like you see in the United States, right? It's a community where if you go to Marseille or any of these southern cities that I've been to, and I'm sure many of your listeners have, you see lots of people in full covering. I mean, only their eyes are visible. You could be walking in a Middle Eastern town. And there's rabid anti-Western views there. There's rabid anti-Semitism. There's rabid anti-gay. I talked to friends who are gay in places like Amsterdam, Copenhagen, and there are just areas they won't go to. There are areas where single women or women who are not in, you know, a group and a company don't feel safe to go, and people don't want to talk about this. But it's a serious problem. The problem behind it, Kathleen, is that in the United States, while we've had a few problems, in the United States, when you come here, you can come from Somalia or China or Russia or wherever. We think of you as an American. We think of you as wanting to become America, and we have a notion of a melting pot that's been under attack, mostly by intellectuals, wrongly. But it's a melting pot. Being a melting pot doesn't mean that you have to give up feeling that you're proud of your Chinese or South Asian heritage or Jewish heritage or whatever it may be. I mean, there are plenty of people around Wisconsin who are listening to you now who feel totally American, totally root for Green Bay Packers, right? But they also are proud that they came from Poland or they came from Sweden or they came from Norway, and that's a part of their identity. These kinds of notions, in short, America is not a nation state, right? In a way that Germany and England and France are. You can move from Japan to Germany and live there for four generations, and you're still not quite a German, right? In a way that you are an American.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them in a moment. Our guest this hour for All Things Political is Charles Lipson. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago because his special area is international relations, international political economy, and modern international history. We started with all of the terrible news that's been coming out of the Middle East. Egypt saying today it bombed Islamic State targets in Libya. in retaliation for mass beheadings of Egyptian Christians on a Libyan beach. So we're trying to get an understanding of all of this. And we do want to remind you, tomorrow at this time, we will have a much closer look at ISIS. Our guest will be the Atlantic feature writer, Graham Wood, whose article, What ISIS Really Wants, is the cover story for the March issue of the magazine. Welcoming phone calls, we'll move to, let's move to Hillary Clinton. We haven't talked about her for a long time. Did the Democrats really want to nominate anyone other than Hillary Clinton? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Scott Walker, who's in the top three when you look at polls. It's early. It's very early, but he's capturing a lot of attention among Republican voters in Iowa and New Hampshire and elsewhere. So those are a few of the areas that we'll move into on this President's Day. Welcoming your phone calls, our lines are open for you at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For you to join all things political, 800-486-8655 is our number. Professor Charles Lipson, professor of political science, who specializes in international relations and international political history at the University of Chicago, is our guest this hour, and we have lines open for him. Let's start with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Today what I'd like to talk about is good stuff, because it seems to me in terms of citizenship, the problem is not smarter. It's just a matter of people working a little harder to read more and listen more. On domestic areas, there's a new book out called The Poison Spring, written by a former EPA worker who's critical of both parties. I encourage people to look at that. And then the other thing is a word that I can't use on the air, but it starts with A, and it's a theory put out by a gentleman named Aaron James that compares people of that category along with psychopaths and the influence of the corporate world on that. And then in foreign policy, I just encourage people to take a look at an old standard film, Romero, which relates to what the Pope is doing currently in terms of putting him on the path to sainthood, and also Kill a Messenger, which was about the drug issue and Gary Webb. And finally, when you wonder why people hate us, look at some of the books that have come out on this. A Question of Torture by Alfred McCoy, UW history professor. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and Imperial Ambitions by Noam Chomsky. In fact, people have a lot of reasons to hate us based on our behavior in the past, and we ought to take a look at this.
Thanks very much. Does our behavior in the past give rise to groups like ISIS and ISIL, do you think, or not, Professor Lipson?
There are a lot of reasons why people around the world hate us. But I don't think that hatred of what Jim was talking about, treatment of Native Americans or something, it is what's driving it. The United States has separated religion from the polity. The state does not control the religion. I can be Jewish or Christian or Hindu or Muslim. I can I can be elected to office. The government can't tell us what to do in terms of our religion, and all of these things are anathema to people who think that not only do they know. Not only has God told us the right way to organize everything, but they personally know what that is, and that the state's job should be to enforce that on earth. And one of the problems that immediately creates is the following. I can disagree with George Bush or Barack Obama, and it's a political disagreement. But if I disagree with the Ayatollah in Iran, I'm an apostate. I'm a heretic. And that's what these countries want to set up. They're not just against us. They have a totally pernicious vision of the world. And if people don't understand that about the radical Islamists movement, if they think that it's all about us, I think they're sort of missing a big part of the story.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Ron in Sparta. Hi, Ron.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, my question is, from the radical Islam who bring up their children, teach them from the time they are knowledgeable enough to understand that their goal is to eliminate the Jewish and infidel population from the earth. How do you change that kind of thought or process? How do you get the Islamic community to be responsible enough to do that? And I'll take the answer off the air.
I think that's a great question, Ron, and I think it's sort of the question of our time. It's in the end, I think, it's not something that can be done from the outside. That's a movement that many Muslims in the United States are themselves deeply concerned about. And I've got to say that part of the problem in the world is that some of our allies, and here I'm thinking in particular of the Saudis, although they've been our political allies, have propagated around the world with extensive money and setting up mosques and all the rest, a form of intolerance within their own religion, intolerance for other groups, that makes it harder. And people are unwilling, good people, are unwilling to look at this as a serious problem for fear, I think, that we'll, quote, be blaming the victim and so forth. But you have young Palestinian children who are taught jihad from the very beginning, and they're taught that the most evil people in the world are Jews. I mean, how can this possibly lead to anything other than future disasters?
Thanks for the call, Ron. Let's switch to politics in the USA for a moment. So I was thinking about Hillary Clinton yesterday, mm-hmm. and I was just wondering, do the Democrats really want to nominate anyone else? Is there anybody other than Hillary Clinton?
One of the problems that any party that has been in power for the presidency for 8 years is that the bench becomes weaker normally because the president sucks a lot of the oxygen out of the room. And I think people recognize that there are a lot of weaknesses in the Clinton candidacy. Her actual accomplishments, as opposed to her job titles, are fairly thin. She's not a great campaigner, even though she stood next to the greatest campaigner since Ronald Reagan. In Bill Clinton. I mean, just a fabulous political mind and a fabulous campaigner. She's not all that good, and she makes mistakes. I mean, we came out of the White House broke. I mean, you know, okay, we couldn't pay our two mortgages. I mean, these are just mistakes, right, in the same way that Romney made mistakes. So the problem is not that just that Hillary is at the head of the pack, but ask yourself, who's behind her? Now, somebody could come out of the pack in the same way that Barack Obama did, but it's not like there's an obvious winner. People talk about people like the Maryland governor, O'Malley, but people don't know much about him, and he wasn't able to even get, in a deep blue state, get a Democratic successor elected there. So, I mean, there's not a very deep bench. I don't know what's going to happen, actually, but I do not. It's very hard to win a third term for a party. The only time it's happened since World War II has been George H.W. Bush, right, after Reagan. Reagan was elected to a third term, in effect. But it's really hard, and Hillary is, it's hard to see who's challenging her right now.
And in terms of the Republican side, let's start with the governor of the state of Wisconsin. Do you think that Governor Scott Walker has a chance at all of this, at the nomination?
Absolutely.
Do you really?
Absolutely. Here's the way that I kind of look at the Republican side of things. The first thing is, if you want to ask yourself, can a Republican become president of the United States, I think you ought to concentrate on two states, Ohio and Florida, and ask yourself, could this man or woman win that state in a general election? If the answer is no, as I think it is for a Ted Cruz or a Mike Huckabee or, you know, a number of other Rick Santorum candidates who appeal to parts of the Republican base, then the answer is that person will not become president of the United States. Okay? Yeah, they may become the nominee, but they're not going to become the president because they won't be able to carry states you have to be able to carry. I mean, and those are, it's not just those two states. If you don't carry those, you're not going to carry Virginia either, right?
Mm-hmm.
So can Scott Walker potentially do that? Yes. Could John Kasich do that? Yes. Could Jeb Bush do that? Yes. There's a limited number of people who can. Jeb Bush has two or three negatives. He's actually a very competent governor. People who know him like him, think he's a smart, capable guy. And a lot of the criticism has been focused on, within the Republican Party, his positions on immigration and Common Core. He was actually extremely successful as an education governor in Florida. But I think his weaknesses are somewhat different. The first is, it's not as if Bush 41 and Bush 43 were Washington and Lincoln here, you know. So it's not as if the cloak of the family name will carry him far in the general election. It'll carry him in the primaries, not because people love the name, but because he's inheriting the fundraising apparatus and the campaign apparatus. The second thing is that the critical issue that Romney gave up in running against President Obama was he couldn't campaign seriously against Obamacare because it was so close
yes.
to Romneycare. And the critical issue that Jeb Bush would give up if he's campaigning against Hillary, and she may not be the nominee, but let's assume she is, he would be giving up the issue of fresh, new, we need to turn the page, it's time for something new. So Rubio could make that argument, Scott Walker can make that argument, Kasich could make that argument, and so forth, but Jeb Bush cannot. And so I think, I mean, the fact that the Washington Post and the New York Times are attacking Scott Walker, that tells you how serious he is. And the New York Times has had to withdraw some of its silly criticisms. I mean, they can't tell us what President Obama did in college, but they're gonna send 16 reporters out to investigate why Scott Walker took a job rather than finishing the last semester of college. It's ludicrous.
You don't think that should be investigated?
It's perfectly fine. But if you to investigate, it's not wrong to investigate it, but if you go around and investigate that and don't investigate similar issues with other candidates, it just looks like a hatchet job. And why does it look like a hatchet job? Because it is.
Let's go to more phone calls for you. Anita in Gurnee is our next caller. Hi, Anita.
Hi. This is great. I have this thought, and I'd like to know if your guest agrees, and I'd really like to get his perspective. I thought from the beginning that Walker was put in place in a very, very liberal state that really, really helped in presidential elections to carry it democratically. I think he was put in place to carry that state for the next presidential election. And I think that Rahner was put in place in Illinois for the same reason, to deliver.
What is the main,
and
what,
I'd like to know if your guest agrees with that and what he thinks. And then also the upcoming the election now, in fact, in Chicago, how influential that is, depending on which one of those candidates gets in, will that be in delivering Chicago or part of Illinois for the presidential election?
Illinois is going to go blue, I'm almost certain. I mean, it's conceivable that a Scott Walker, John Kasich might have a shot at it, but I would be kind of surprised. What I was trying to ask you, and what I didn't quite understand, was what did you mean put in place? I mean, I
think
these
exactly
are local
that,
races.
I don't. That was their job, to get in there and keep your feet there, and you're going to deliver just like the Dailies always did and just like Rahm Emanuel is doing. That's what I think. I think they're put in strategically. Wisconsin has always been a very influential state in the presidential election. And if we can, and when I say we, I'm a liberal, but if the people turn that around and turn it conservative, that's going to be a huge coup for the conservative party, don't you think, or not?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that, but I don't think anybody, quote, put them in place, except that I think that that there has been a movement within the Republican Party, and you saw it in the last senatorial set of elections, to try to avoid having more extreme right-wing candidates who could win the primary but would be unlikely to win the general election. So in that sense, people like Karl Rove did play the role that you're talking about. But I think we exaggerate the role of national parties. Parties are a lot less important as organizations than they used to be. Barack Obama got himself elected, and he put in place a great team, or they helped put him in place. I mean, you know, he and David Axelrod were a great pair. David's an old friend of mine. I have the greatest respect for David, even though he and I disagree on many issues. I just think he is one of the greatest political minds of our time, and there wasn't a national Democratic Party that got Barack Obama elected. The national Democrats were sort of thinking Hillary would be the successor.
What do you make of, evidently this is going to, reports are go to the Supreme Court. I'm interested, because I don't know that much about him, the new governor of the state of Illinois, New York Times, you probably saw the editorial over the weekend, giving him grief for issuing the executive order last week, barring state employees from assessing fair share fees on some of the workers. Will that go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and how has the response been in Illinois?
Illinois faces a really severe financial problem, and that's the main concern that the governor will be judged on. I think that the issues like these issues where he is in effect attacking public service, public sector unions, are part of this bigger battle. In the heyday of the unions, public sector unions, working with private sector unions, put into the state constitution a rule that their benefits could never be diminished. So all of the changes that would be necessary to make in future pensions run a risk of being found unconstitutional. It's not clear what future benefits are, but let's say you're a new 25-year-old worker and we want to change the pensions for you starting next year, your contributions over the next 25 years, would that diminish your future benefits? That's the big issue. The unions have fought hard against it. It's not really, it's hard to see any way that the state can come out of this fiscal crisis, and the city can come of Chicago can come out of its fiscal crisis without solving these pension problems. And the reason that Rahm Emanuel was elected by the city, I mean, the nation may view Emanuel as being sort of part of the Obama team and a liberal and so forth, but he was put in place here because people think he's one tough customer and that he's the only person who the unions opposed, and he is... there's a real possibility he could get these pensions in place, but he faces legal obstacles that are formidable. These are really serious problems, and the fact that Indiana and Wisconsin have made a lot of progress has not been missed on the citizens of Illinois.
Professor Charles Lipson, our guest for All Things Political, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, where he has special interest and teaches in the areas of international relations, international political economy, and modern international history. We're welcoming phone calls for him. We have some emails that have come in. We'll go to those in just a moment and welcome more of your calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655 talk at WPR.org, or you can go to Facebook and leave messages there too, which we can read if during the show or after the show or on the show. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email, Professor Lipson, from Dave, who thinks on President's Day we should be judging a president by the way the country was handed to him by the previous president and how he left it for the people when the next president is elected. He's interested in your thoughts on that.
I think that's actually a terrific criterion, or it's criteria because he's made two. He was handed, President Obama was handed a country in pretty difficult shape economically. We were in the midst of a meltdown. And for people, for your younger listeners who may not remember it, but you and I do, Kathleen, it seemed like the floor had dropped out and nobody knew where the bottom was. It was very scary. And he stabilized the economy. There have been complaints, and I think that those, you know, those are politically significant complaints that the economy didn't recover as robustly as some thought it could and should. But he nevertheless did a good job on that. I think he had a good situation at long last in Iraq, and he is handing a much worse situation off to his successors. I think he's never really wanted to do in foreign policy a lot. And it's not just Iraq, by the way. Things are much worse in terms of Iran. Things are much worse in terms of Russia. So I think he didn't inherit a great situation internationally, but he is handing off a significantly worse one. He did inherit a bad situation domestically, and he is handing off a better one.
John in Madison is next. Hi, John.
Yeah, it's hello?
Yes, John, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Kathleen, Professor. I'm calling to talk about a small but I think important point about the way we talk about war, specifically the expression boots on the ground. I find that dehumanizing and in an important way. We put feet, we put arms and legs and brains and minds and people with eyesight, and that's what we put in a war zone. We should not be calling American soldiers pieces of clothing. And so I just think for this kind of discourse that let's humanize it. Let's make people think about the true cost when we talk about war.
That's such a great point. That really is. I think part of it, you see this in every profession. Doctors who have to work with people dying every day talk about flatlining, right? Meaning that things that are going beep, 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 all of a sudden just go beep. It's a flat line. And it, part of its purpose is to allow them to think professionally about the issue without having to. It's a reason doctors, no doctor wants to be a surgeon working on her own daughter, right? She wants another surgeon to do it because it's a professional job and she doesn't want to do it personally. But I must say that in the terms of boots on the ground, it's a term the military themselves use, soldiers themselves use it. And what we're trying to do is distinguish, I think, between the term has come to mean not just human beings on the ground, but actual deployments of soldiers and not just special forces. Those are human beings with arms and legs and brains, too. But when we send in a SEAL team to do a job or intelligence agents, we're talking about a very different thing than a commitment of ground troops. So we're trying to make shorthand distinctions, but you raise a very important point. We should never forget that people come back like Representative Tammy Duckworth here without legs and so forth.
Right. Thank you, John. Let's try to get the remaining three callers if we can. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Kathleen. I'm interested in the professor's assessment of Scott Walker's candidacy. I think one of the problems he has is that due to his tax cut policies, he's put a $2 billion hole in the state budget. Now, I see him more as a vice presidential candidate than a presidential one, but I'm wondering if the professor thinks that even if he got the vice presidential nod, could he do any better than Paul Ryan in carrying Wisconsin? I'll take my
okay,
answer
Jim.
Up here.
Thank you.
No vice president's ever carried a state since Lyndon Johnson helped President Kennedy carry Texas. Scott Walker has a genuine chance at being the presidential candidate. I think that the next thing he's got to prove is that he can raise the money for a national campaign. But I think the fact that President Obama was such a sizzle will actually help Scott Walker, who's going to sell himself as a steak without much sizzle. Nobody would accuse him of being somebody who electrifies a room. And but I think that people may feel like a person who packs a room with tens of thousands of cheering people who faint may not necessarily. We may have overlooked whether or not that person had much experience governing and so forth. Scott Walker, I think, is going to be a formidable candidate, but issues like state budgets and whether or not how good a job he's done in general in Wisconsin, on which your listeners know much more and have stronger feelings than I do, will be a major, major issue.
Interesting. Let's quickly go to Carol in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Carol.
I'd like to know how he feels about Elizabeth Warren as a candidate. I think she has a really good grassroots group behind her, and I think with the fight for the student loans, she would have a student and a young vote.
All right. Thanks, Carol. 30 seconds. Professor Lipson.
She's a niche candidate. She could win the Democratic Party, but she would have the same problems that George McGovern would have on the national stage. She's just too far to the left to carry a lot of America.
Thank you, Carol, so much for your call. Professor Lipson, thanks for joining us on this President's Day.
What a pleasure. Let me just tell you, Kathleen, I love listening to your show. I listen to it all the time on the Internet.
Do you really?
You should know that it's on the Internet.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you to say. Thank you. Yes,
it's
we are.
True.
All right. Thank you. We are on the internet, as a matter of fact. Professor Charles Lipson, professor of political science, University of Chicago, areas of interest, international relations, international political economy, and modern international history. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and to K.P. as well for on-air production. If you didn't get on the air, leave messages on Facebook if you can do that, because we love to read those messages. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. It's President's Day. Who were the best American presidents? What do you think? Call us. We'll talk about it hour two.